Our dependence on connected technology is growing faster than our ability to secure it, especially in areas affecting public safety and human life.
I'm Bryson Bort, and this is Hack the Plant. Electricity, finance, transportation, our water supply. We take these critical infrastructure systems for granted, but they're all becoming increasingly dependent on the internet to function. Every day, I ask and look for answers to the questions. Does our connectivity leave us more vulnerable to attacks by our enemies? I'm a senior fellow at the R Street Institute and the co-founder of the nonprofit ICS Village, educating people on critical infrastructure security with hands-on examples, not just nerd stuff. I founded GRIM in 2013, a consultancy that works the front lines of these problems every day for clients all over the world.
It's playing out in Israel right now, where hackers have been going after Israeli water systems. Again, not to steal information from them, but to change the setting on the chemicals in Israeli water.
Each month, I'm going to walk you through my world of hackers, insiders, and government working on the front lines of cybersecurity and public safety to protect the systems you rely upon every day.
If you think that the small town water authorities and the mom and pop sized companies have better cybersecurity in the US than the Israelis do, I have really, really bad news for you.
An attack on our critical infrastructure, the degradation to the point that they can no longer support us, means that we go back to the Stone Age literally overnight.
If we think the government's going to solve it for us, we're wrong. We have to help them.
This is not a podcast for the faint of heart. If you want to meet those protecting the world and what problems keep them up at night, then this is the podcast for you. I'm Bryson Bort, and this is Hack the Plant. For today's episode, I'm joined by two guests, Colonel Douglas Fletcher and Colonel Eric Mitchell of the Army Cyber Institute, the think tank for the Army. Colonel Fletcher is the chief data scientist, and Colonel Mitchell is the critical infrastructure key resources research lead. They work together to lead a multi-year critical infrastructure project and exercise. That's what we're here to talk about. A cyber incident response conducted by the Army called Jack Voltaic, or JV for short. This research series tested cybersecurity preparedness of industrial control systems at the local level around the country.
What Jack Voltaic does, it takes a bottoms-up approach to this critical infrastructure resilience by looking at the city level. You know, so we're not focused on region or multi-state, but the action is happening down at the city level where you've got the critical infrastructure and the populations at the highest concentrations.
JV1 was conducted in New York City and focused on a physical attack coupled with an attack on the financial industry as well as the subway. And what that showed was within each of the critical infrastructure sectors, there are communication pipelines where people report on incidents, but there was not a lot of crosstalk between those different critical infrastructure sectors. So one of the big lessons is we still have a lot of the same issues with these silos. Prioritizing cybersecurity still isn't happening. I mean, we have all of these attacks that are happening on a frequent basis. And when it comes down to it, resources are the hardest part. People don't have the time, the personnel, and the funding to really be able to beef up their cybersecurity in the way that they should. And so we see that time and again. And then we also see the identification of a cyber problem tends to take longer than it should.
What do we need to do to improve the security of critical infrastructure? What does building up resilience at the municipal level look like? How can the military work with cities to protect our nation from cybersecurity threats? We'll discuss in the conversation. Welcome, Doug and Erica. First up, Erica, what is your role? What do you do?
So my role is as the Critical Infrastructure Key Resources Research Group Lead at the Army Cyber Institute. It's a lot of words. What it basically means is my research group looks at issues within critical infrastructure. So industrial control systems. We're looking at all 16 critical infrastructure sectors and how cyber attacks in those sectors can influence military operations, such as force projection.
And Doug, you work with Erica on this. What do you do?
I am actually the chief data scientist here at the Army Cyber Institute. And prior to this, I was also working as the project lead for Jack Voltaic 3, which was our Jack Voltaic experiment that we ran in the cities of Charleston and Savannah that looked at the impacts of cyber attacks against commercial critical infrastructure on Army force projection.
What is the Army Cyber Institute?
So the Army Cyber Institute is basically a think tank for the Army, where we look at various cyber perspectives. And our goal is to look, you know, at least 3 to 5 years out, as opposed to looking at current problems right now. So, like, for example, with our force projection, right now we haven't had a cyber attack interfere with any type of Army force projection, but we're exploring how it could and how we can mitigate that before it ever happens.
And Doug, just to keep it fun, what do you think the Army Cyber Institute is?
Well, as Erica said, the Army Cyber Institute, we're that think tank. If you look across kind of the spectrum of the Army cyber community, you know, you've got the operational arm, which is the Army Cyber Command. You've got the educational training, which is the Cyber Center of Excellence down at Fort Gordon. And then the Army Cyber Institute represents that innovation part, where we're trying to look 5-10 years out. What's going to be the next thing, that the next big thing in cyber that the Army needs to think about? And how can we better inform commanders and leaders throughout the Army about the types of response and how we're going to handle it?
We're trying to avoid strategic surprise.
So, Erica, how do you define industrial control systems or critical infrastructure? You mentioned the 16 different SSAs being in scope.
Okay, so critical infrastructure, the Department of Homeland Security defined it as 16 sectors. I hope you don't want me to go down the list off of memory, because I can't. But basically what we're looking at are those backbone pieces that keep our country running. So, for example, you know, utilities, that's the energy sector. And within the energy sector, you have gas and electric, which are not always necessarily provided by the same people. So you have those types of things. And what we look at, industrial control systems, and again, without going too far into the weeds, those are the actual physical pieces of hardware that run this backbone. So for example, if you're looking at the energy sector and you're looking at an electrical grid, there are very specific pieces of hardware in place to run that, and they're designed to run for 30 years without being replaced. Well, you know, as time has progressed and things have gotten more technologically connected, we thought, hey, wouldn't it be a really great idea to put these things on the network so we could reduce sending people out to fix things, and we can monitor and repair, you know, from a distance. Well, what happens to everything you connect to the internet? Other people want to connect to that thing. So those industrial control systems that basically provide your sensors for how your infrastructure is working and also gives it signals, for example, open a relay, close a relay, now that's connected to the internet. And so you have bad actors who are attempting to connect to that. And, you know, sometimes it's just curiosity. People want to see how things work, and they're not necessarily bad actors. And other times you have people who, you know, want to throw a monkey wrench in the system and want to have control for whatever reason. You know, one good example is like a programmable logic controller, a PLC. It's designed to be ruggedized in there for a very long time. And if you interfere with it, it can prevent electricity from flowing where it needs to. And then you have a problem within your grid that you either have to send a human out to fix, or, you know, you may end up having to also replace that equipment. And it's so specialized that you don't have your, you know, average IT person that's really familiar with how these industrial control systems work. It's more the realm of an electrical engineer than an IT worker. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely does. And Doug, I'd like to put you on the spot for the same question.
What Eric has said is exactly right. I mean, you look at these sensors that we have out there, these industrial control sensors, and they are what help this critical or what make this critical infrastructure run. Now, where kind of our work focuses is if something happens to one of these industrial control systems in the energy sector, you know, what are the different interdependencies that exist with the other sectors? How does that carry over to that? You know, we had, you could look at is this the same type of sensor that they may use over with water or with some other? So if there's something wrong with the firmware there, are they going to have problems with that too? It's really trying to capture how the any kind of attacks against the critical infrastructure and the industrial control systems can perpetuate throughout the different sectors, and then eventually and potentially cascade and create some very significant physical effects as a result of a cyber intrusion.
So what kinds of industrial control systems are there in the Army?
That is a very good question, Bryson. So we have a lot of the same industrial control systems that the civilian sector does. However, we're a little bit different inside the fence. So we do have programmable logic controllers. For example, on certain installations, we have our own water treatment plants to include, like here at West Point, we have our very own wastewater treatment plant, and therefore we have programmable logic controllers in there. We do run, you know, our own mini grids within the military. What we don't have are some of the bigger hardware that you would see, you know, at a regional power distribution center or something like that, where the Army has very similar things on a much smaller scale, I guess, is the easiest way of putting it.
I think it's also interesting. We will get into this a little bit later about public-private partnership. But while the Army does have dedicated industrial control systems to run core functions on a post, they also, in a lot of cases, depend on the local community and those utilities to provide different services as well.
Absolutely.
Yes, Bryson, that's correct. It's Erica mentioned about how West Point has their own wastewater treatment plant that's located here. You know, we've also seen where other installations have kind of their own little part of the power energy grid that represents those. But there's still that connection to the community that exists through the critical infrastructure that we have on our different installations. And it can be slightly different for each of the installations that are out there.
And that's a great segue into what is Jack Voltaic?
So Jack Voltaic is a research series that has started to look at the interdependencies between civilian critical infrastructure and the DoD. And so the first iteration was born from a cyber mutual assistance workshop. So the energy sector for many, many years has had the concept of mutual assistance. If there's a big storm in one part of the country, you'll see teams being dispatched from all over the country to get those lines back in place and restore service in the affected areas. So CW3, Judy Escobel, had the idea that what if we could do the same thing with cyber? And that was back in 2016. And so she put together a cyber mutual assistance workshop that brought in some leading industry players and worked on developing these public-private partnerships and really bringing everybody to the table to say, what would it look like if we had to respond to cyber? How would our interdependencies affect that cyber response? How could we possibly assist each other? And so after they had the first cyber mutual assistance workshop, they decided to try an exercise. So JV1 was conducted in New York City and focused on a physical attack coupled with an attack on the financial industry, as well as the subway. And what that showed was, one, there are a lot of silos of excellence, as we like to call them. Within each of the critical infrastructure sectors, there are communication pipelines where people report on incidents, but there was not a lot of crosstalk between those different critical infrastructure sectors. And so after going through that, it actually led to the development of the New York City Cyber Command in order to kind of have some type of unified cyber response and be able to minimize the amount of information that stayed within these silos. And we've maintained a relationship with New York City and continue to do workshops with them, you know, even to the present day. And after that, we looked at JV 2.0. We decided to take it a little bit further and do something a little bit bigger and looked at a hurricane coupled with an opportunistic cyber attack. And with that hurricane scenario, one thing we noticed was we kind of took the ports out of play. We wanted to know what would happen at our Surface Distribution and Deployment Command, which is an Army transcom battalion that kind of focuses on the movement of Army equipment. They participated, but because the hurricane closed down the port, it kind of took a lot of the cyber off of the table for them. And so we had a lot of good findings come out of Houston, some of the similar findings from New York City that we still have a lot of these silos of excellence. By moving to another large city, they're very, very responsive to the physical. Their reaction to the hurricane is, you know, on point. They know how to react to that. They've hosted several large events. They know how to react to any type of physical issue. But when it comes to cyber, one, it's hard to know that it's cyber at first. You know, the first instinct is, hey, I have a glitch in my system. Let me restart it. Or, hey, you know, I'm experiencing problems. I wonder if anybody else is. Let me just kind of wait and see what's going on. And so that is still an issue. And then we rolled into JV3, where we wanted the ports back in play. And from there, I'm going to kick it to Doug, because he really was the driving effort behind us doing a more regional scenario with two ports. So, Doug, take it away on JV3.
Hey, thanks, Eric. And before I get into details of JV3, I want to highlight something that makes the Jack Voltaic Research Project unique. You know, there's a lot of different type of cyber exercises going on out there. But really what Jack Voltaic does, it takes a bottoms-up approach to this critical infrastructure resilience by looking at the city level. You know, so we're not focused on region or multi-state, but the action is happening down at the city level, where you've got the critical infrastructure and the populations at the highest concentrations. Furthermore, Jack Voltaic builds around the objectives and the goals of its participants. What we want to do is we want to explore what the different participants want to explore. Because as Erica mentioned, you know, with Jack Voltaic 3, we wanted to bring the ports in play and look at how it impacts force projection. And we can do that by addressing some of the concerns or the objectives of the participants. And then finally, with Jack Voltaic, what makes it really unique is we're not just looking at the ports, but we're trying to pull in as many different critical infrastructure sectors as possible to see how the different interdependencies would affect one another. Because we understand that, you know, okay, yeah, you can do a direct attack or something against the port is going to stop things. But what about kind of the relationship between the port and the road network and the rail network and the energy sector? Is there going to be a small something that happens in the energy sector that could potentially cascade and impact the port? Jack Voltaic wants to look at those different interdependencies between the critical infrastructure sectors. And that's really kind of what makes it a unique event compared to some of the other great cybersecurity exercises that are going on out today.
Peeling it back a little bit more, can you explain what force projection means and why that precipitates a focus on ports?
Yeah, sure. So when we talk in force projection, really for the Army, we're talking about moving people and equipment from the continental U.S. to overseas somewhere where they have a mission and they've got to do operations. And so, you know, for us to do that, we have different assets available to us, whether it's through air or sea. And the reason why the ports are in play is because we use sea vessels and sea lift as one of the primary means to get the equipment from the U.S. to overseas. So that's why it's important to have the ports there, because, you know, when you look at, we talked earlier about public-private partnerships, this force projection mission really is kind of a public-private partnership in that, you know, we're working surface deployment distribution command that Erica mentioned before is working with the port to get vessels loaded, to get them ready and get them sent on their way so that they can have the equipment and time there to meet the commander's mission or give the commander the capabilities he needs to meet his mission overseas.
So how were the two of you paired together for this?
So that's an interesting story. When I first came into the Army Cyber Institute, I had finished all of my PhD work, all the in-person work, basically. So all of my coursework, and I was ABD. And so was Doug. So we both came in and we both had to finish. So when I came in, I hit the ground running on Jack Voltaic 2.0, like I actually started before I even arrived at West Point. And then I also did a Jack Voltaic 2.5 workshop series, and that was in seven different port cities around the U.S. And so I didn't have any time to work on my dissertation at all while I was also doing the Jack Voltaic lead. And so Doug finished his dissertation, and it was masterful. He is a statistical genius. So he stepped in and took over leading the next iteration of Jack Voltaic so I could finish my dissertation, which I did, and graduated in May of this year. So then I was able to come back, and he's able to follow his first love and move back into the data science, statistical analysis side of the house. And I can do the strategy, policy, you know, the squishy cyber portion of Jack Voltaic that I love.
And I think the pairing too also though is to blend that squishy with the stats and really, you know, to try to capture a lot of data from this event and then use that data and provide different avenues of analysis, whether we're you know, looking at the different things that were said and how extracting how they pertain to recommendations for policy or whatnot, or, you know, doing some natural language processing on that, building networks from there and moving forward there, or taking events that we've talked about in the Jack Voltaic 3 scenario and translating them to different simulations that provide a different picture of what the participants experienced during that event. So it was a great pairing, one that I think has been very effective for the Jack Voltaic series, and I know especially for Jack Voltaic 3.
You mentioned earlier the bottoms-up approach to Jack Voltaic being one of the defining characteristics that makes it different. How do you choose the cities or the regions that are participating in this? How do you bring different government agencies and different elements of the private sector together?
So the selection of the cities in the case of JV3 was based off of the Army's Defender 2020 force projection exercise that they were moving men, women, and equipment from stateside to Germany to conduct an exercise in May. Through looking through kind of how that was going to flow, we identified that Charleston and Savannah were two of the key ports that were going to be moving equipment there. You know, that's for Jack Voltaic 3, that's how we kind of decided on that. We also realized that, hey, there's a regional relationship there that we can potentially explore. Which, you know, if something happens at one port, what's going to happen at the other port? You know, what are there any connections, any interdependencies that may exist there? So that was the thought process we went through when selecting for Jack Voltaic 3. As to how to get people to come to the table, that's basically kind of getting on the ground and working the contacts. Unlike an Army unit, you know, where we can request our headquarters to task someone to participate and they're forced to participate. When it comes to Jack Voltaic, we could walk in and say, hey, we're the government, we're here to help. But we've really got to go in and build the relationships with the communities, you know, describe to them what we're trying to do, you know, relay to them how it can help them, talk to them about, you know, kind of what they're experiencing, what they want to get out of it. And then from there, you know, you you start expanding out and pulling and more people get it. And what we found is, you know, when we go into these communities, they're generally excited to do this. You know, they want to do these cyber incident response exercises because that's something they're great when it comes to physical responses, you know, whether it's a hurricane, they've got that down. But when it's a cyber incident, there's still a little kind of uncertainty about how are we going to do that. And so once we get in there and we start making some contacts, they tend to reach out and bring in more people that would be interested in participating. And so we're able to kind of build that coalition of the willing to put together this event.
So to piggyback on that, JV1 was more proximity than anything else. It was kind of a proof of concept type thing. Is this something worth doing, something worth exploring? Are we going to get good information out of it? So with New York City only being an hour up the road, it was a lot easier to put something together. And then from there, we've had volunteers. We always have more volunteers than we have resources to conduct Jack Voltaics. But for Houston, we had volunteers who said, look, we'll do a lot of the legwork. We have a lot of the existing relationships, and we just want you to pick us. And so the folks down there in Houston really, really, you know, came together and did a lot of the trust building and coalition building for us. JV3, because it was tied to an Army exercise, was unique in that we had to do a lot more of the relationship building and trust building ourselves. And so that JV 2.5 workshop series that I mentioned, which basically shared the findings from the previous iterations of Jack Voltaic, and then also did like a mini exercise, we conducted those in Charleston and Savannah in order to kind of gauge how they would feel about having a JV there. The other option would have been Beaumont, Texas, but they had already participated in the one in Houston. So we weren't quite ready to revisit the same place we had already been. And we're trying to still explore new places. And so, you know, even now we have plenty of volunteers, but we're limited in the resources we have to plan and conduct these exercises because it takes, you know, 18 to 24 months, especially with us coming from the outside doing the relationship building and trust building with these cities.
What have you learned from the multi-year effort with Jack Voltaic?
So one of the big lessons is we still have a lot of the same issues with these silos. I would say first and foremost, prioritizing cybersecurity still isn't happening. I mean, we have all of these attacks that are happening on, you know, on a frequent basis. And when it comes down to it, resources are the hardest part. You know, people don't have the time, the personnel, and the funding to really be able to beef up their cybersecurity in the way that they should. And so we see that time and again. And then we also see the identification of a cyber problem tends to take longer than it should. Within our scenarios, it's kind of artificially built in. In the future, we're trying to move to where people have more of an opportunity to identify that there's a cyber issue. But as we conduct these tabletop exercises, you know, we ask people what they think it might be. And it's rare that we get people thinking it's something cyber on their own. Obviously, because it's a cyber exercise, they figure at some point it's got to be cyber, but they're not sure. And then that kind of leads into another repeated finding, and that's who has the authority to declare a cyber incident, and what does declaring a cyber incident even look like? Because there are resources you can bring to bear once you declare an incident, but knowing how to declare it and what the channels are for notifying that there's a cyber incident and requesting resources, those mechanisms just aren't really solidly in place right now at the municipal level. Whereas on the other side, I participated in a national tabletop exercise that had representatives from government agencies. And at the national level, they like to reiterate that they have these plans, and if something were to go wrong, they're fully ready to deal with them. But the disconnect is the local level is the front line. That's where the problem is going to happen. The national level is where the resources are, and they're the ones who can probably solve the problem. But there's no solid connection between that local municipality and the federal level in order to make these things happen. And that's what we're looking to try to improve, getting people to understand how to make that connection.
Yeah, and I want to add to that and say, you know, what we see is, you know, at that municipal level, you know, where things occur that, you know, you don't have that catastrophic, hey, the power grid is shut down. You don't have some catastrophic effect that requires the immediate allocation of federal assets to the problem and fix it. Instead, it's kind of small things. Okay, the traffic lights aren't working right. Basically, you know, our HR systems are infected. And okay, so we can see that. We can start working on that. But these smaller incidents that kind of might go under the radar, what we tried to look at with these is how do they cascade to where we can get to a threshold where someone can say, this is a cyber incident and I need help. And it's really, I think, as Erica mentioned, you know, what we've trying to kind of help bridge that gap between the perception at the at higher echelons and the perception at the city level. And that's one of the great things about our unique approach to this is that we're able to provide that change of perspective on the cyber incident response and allow kind of more input to go back and give the feedback to what our current plans are. I would also like to kind of highlight here, one of the things that JV does is it brings kind of the operators and the leaders to the table at the same time, to where they can talk and they can see how each other's operate, you know, where an IT or cybersecurity professional would see something and then how they communicate it to the leader and what the leader's response is. You know, with that, Erica kind of hinted on it, is that, you know, there's still kind of not an understanding of cybersecurity as a platform issue. It's something that, especially at the local level, would you rather have a robust cybersecurity program or fix potholes? And so helping people or communicating that it's, you know, cybersecurity has to be part of that platform that all leaders need to understand at every level. And we see evidence of that throughout the past couple of years where, you know, small towns in Texas are getting ransomware. City of Baltimore, city of Atlanta. It's not a problem that you can overlook. And so, you know, emphasizing that for leaders to start emphasizing that that's part of their way of helping protect their communities and helping to, you know, provide for their welfare of their citizens, I think is one of those things that we're also trying to achieve with the Jack Voltaic series.
If you had your druthers, where would you want to take it?
So for me personally, the next one I'd like to see would probably be another regional one. And I'd like to see it tied to either a global defender that basically is looking at moving equipment from the U.S. to Europe. Or there's also the Indo-PACOM region, the Pacific Command region, which would allow us to conduct it in Hawaii. So that would be another nice opportunity. But it would also be regional, looking at that connection between the West Coast of the U.S. and Hawaii and the rest of the PACOM region.
Yeah, and I'd like to add onto that, too, is I think there's a lot of opportunity here to help improve kind of the public-private partnership between an installation and the surrounding community. And I think, you know, what we saw with Jack Voltaic 3, where we had Third ID along with Savannah and Hinesville, Georgia, in there, is there's opportunity for these types of events to help an installation better understand kind of how its critical infrastructure relates to the community, but also to help improve the relationships between the community and the military as well.
All right. So this is how we close out each of these shows. So Erica, we're going to give you two questions first. Actually, you know what? Do you want to mix it up and make Doug go first?
Yes.
Yes, let's do that. So you get the time to think while he has to answer the questions. All right, Doug, for all the money on the table, if you could wave a magic non-internet connected wand, what is one thing that you would change, period, anywhere, bigger than Jack Voltaic, right? If you could wave your wand to change critical infrastructure, what would that be?
I really think the one thing I would want to change is, or improve on, is the how information is shared across critical infrastructures. How do we get that information out there? Because as we saw with events that throughout the Jack Voltaic series, whether it's two or three, you know, something that looks like an anomaly in one sector could be critical information for another sector to know. And it's just, how do you get that sharing to occur, not just across critical infrastructure sectors, but also from, you know, city up to federal? In the cyber domain, we've got to have that. You've got to have that clear situational understanding from left and right and top to bottom. And I think if I could wave a magic wand, that's what I would look for.
Well, now you've waved your magic wand. It's very pretty. Now looking into the crystal ball for a 5-year prediction, what is one good thing and one bad thing that you think is going to happen?
I think the good thing that I see happening is, you know, that the communities are understanding more and more about what cyber can do. And there is a desire to do something about it. And so I think that movement, especially at the city and county level, they understand that could be a challenge. And, you know, they're looking for ways to improve themselves with that. The bad thing, I think, is that, you know, as we continue to improve our cybersecurity posture, our cyber incident response posture, you know, our adversaries are adaptive. And I think, you know, whether it's 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, I think that while we improve, they're still going to find ways to get around that. And, you know, it's, I think until we can get ahead of our adversary, then we're always going to kind of be in this kind of catch up type of game.
All right, Erica, have you composed yourself?
I have.
Aren't you going to ask her different questions?
They're the same questions. That would be funny. That would be great if I did mix it up and be like, all right, are you ready? Now completely something different.
So I'm kind of like the person who wishes for more wishes. If I could wave my magic wand, I would want everybody to get it. I would want everybody to understand the actual risk. And from that, I would expect that people would get the business case for spending money on cybersecurity. I would expect that security would be baked into every piece of hardware that ever connects to the internet ever. I would expect that firmware would always be upgradable, and if it wasn't, people would throw it out. And I would expect that privacy settings for devices that you connect to the network would be, you know, very granular, and you would be allowed to make decisions on your own home devices, as well as, you know, our devices that we place on enterprise networks. So I'm the person who wishes for more wishes with my wish.
All right, you're still on the hook for prediction.
So my prediction is the good thing that would come of that is that you would have a lot of inherent security. You would put adversaries, you know, in a defensive posture where they've got to work that much harder to get into your system. It's not, you know, let me go out on the dark web and grab some script kiddie stuff and be able to get in, or let me use shodan.io and find, you know, home network devices or devices at state capitals, because they're out there. But the downside to it is really going to be expense. Security costs money. And, you know, that expense is going to be passed on to consumers in the case of, you know, doing it as part of your business case and spending the money on security for your company. It'll inevitably be passed on to consumers. And right now, our economy is a little interesting, you know, due to COVID. However, I think once that initial expense happened, it would be much more manageable in ensuing years. So by the time you hit the 5-year mark, you would probably be reaching more steady state operations. Although your past 5 years, you would have taken a bit of a loss.
All right. This is a grab bag. Anything that you would like to add or close with?
Doug, you want to go first?
I really want to say that, you know, the Jack Voltaic series does offer not just the Army, but communities a unique perspective into cybersecurity and cyber incident response. It's something, it's a tool that we can use to help us kind of better understand this crazy domain known as cyber. But it, most importantly, it's a tool that I think, and something that we can help get after all of these wishes and dreams that that we've talked about here, but also to just help the country be more secure and help the country be more resilient. You know, as we've seen with kind of how we've respond, how we've developed and refined responses to physical incidents, I believe that, you know, we just got to continue to practice and look at how we can get better and get to where a cyber incident response, you know, they get the same kind of repetitions and feeling for that.
And for me, I just want to add that we are still, you know, pursuing the Jack Voltaic research objectives and actually our way forward moving on. We're looking to automate a lot of the process to reduce that planning time from, you know, 18 to 24 months to preferably days. So be on the lookout in the future for possible beta testing of a planning tool if you're a municipality that's looking for a way to kind of self-assess where you're at with your critical infrastructure security. And I appreciate you having us today. And I always love to be able to proselytize about security.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to Hack the Plant, a podcast of the R Street Institute and ICS Village Nonprofit. Subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. Even better, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts so we can reach even more listeners. Tell us what you thought about it and who we should interview next by finding us on Twitter at RSI or at ICS_Village. Finally, if you want to know more about R Street or ICS Village, visit rstreet.org or icsvillage.com. I'm your host, Bryson Borg. Thank you to executive producer Tyler Lowe of Fader Creative, creative producer William Gray, and editor Dominic Sterrett of Sterrett Production.